The intent behind peacocking is more about having a subtle difference or a conversation piece that draws a woman into your frame. Oddly enough, or not, I found that nice, expensive shoes seem to be a natural pull for some girls. This isn't surprising considering most women's obsession with shoes. One thing that's important to remember is women's sensitivity to covert subcommunication, body language, appearance, nonverbal cues, etc. In the briefest glance, they'll size one another up and come to operative conclusions about a woman's status in their girl hierarchy. It follows that they use the same tools with the men they find attractive. Most newly game-aware men who are comfortable enough to venture using peacocking don't realize that a little goes a long way. Your game isn't peacocking. It's just a flashy lure to get the fish to strike. It's up to you to play the fish once it's hooked. The five stages of unplugging. I once read an article about the five stages of grief, confronting death, and how they apply coming into acceptance of a previously rejected truth. Yes, I know, there's no end to the ridiculous interpretations of this played-out pop psych list. But I was curious about how this might apply to an AFC coming to grips with unplugging from the Matrix. So I did a bit of searching. And what did I find on my blog roll search but this? Quote, 1. Denial. Still plugged in. These game guys are a bunch of clowns. There's no way this works on women. Women aren't stupid. What a bunch of misogynists. 2. Anger. Post-red pill. Awareness. This is ridiculous. Why should I have to jump through all of these hoops for women? I just want to be myself. Why couldn't I have been a natural, trademark, alpha? I blame my parents, siblings, teachers, God, liberals, feminist, media, society. Maybe those famous pussy-starved mass murderers weren't so crazy after all. 3. Bargaining unplugged. Well, maybe it does have some good points, but forget the hot girls. They're way out of my league. I'll give it a try if it can help me get around the bases with a plain Jane. Do I have to wear the fuzzy hat and black nail polish? 4. Depression. Bitter taste of the red pill. Wow, women really respond to this puffed up act. And guys spend big bucks on it and wind up with more ass than a toilet seat. And I just joined up for this? The world is sad, and so am I. 5. Acceptance. Game awareness. Maybe this is the way things really work. I guess I should give up the gender relations mythology I've been holding on to. Hey, what do you think of these nags I came up with? End quote. 6. Note, this is a late addition to the list, hardly original and arguably relevant, but I added it for precautionary measures since it's a common after effect of unplugging. Jaded. MGTOW permutations. Fuck learning all these rules. Sex isn't worth it, and women aren't that fun anyway. The last thing I want to do is learn routines or the five stages of pickup. There's too many websites. Too much to read. I can't remember it all, much less sort it all out. Who has all that time to go out and chat up women anyway? It's not like I see any women under 40 at work at my engineering job to practice on. Video games and porn are more fun and more available. I just have to look good and let the women come to me. I get a ton of private messages from forum members and read threads about guys with friends or relatives in or just getting over horrible relationships and how they've tried to unplug them only to run into stiff resistance. Looking at this process to acceptance, it's no wonder why. The bitter taste of the red pill. I'm going to finish this chapter with one of the most important rational male essays I've written according to my readers. I save this for last because it's the most important precaution to keep in mind when your eyes are being opened and you or people you know are worried about your transformation into becoming game red pill aware. A lot gets made of the dark triad or the dark side of game, where a skillful player can sadistically use his newly learned red pill superpowers for evil instead of for the greater benefit of both himself and mankind. Game-aware women, the ones who have been forcibly exhausted of all the pretense of maintaining the illusion that game is a lie, will feel as though it's owed to them, in their concession of game's reality, that men should use game to women's primary benefit. Even to the last effort, women still cling to the tools of a feminized acculturation. Yeah, okay, you got us. Game is really what women want. Hypergamy is the law of womankind. But now it's your responsibility that you use it for the better benefit of society by molding a new breed of improved game-savvy beta men to accommodate a feminine-centric monogamy. You owe us our security for having admitted to the grand illusion that's kept you in thrall for so long. It's an indictment of game-aware women and sympathizing men that they should feel a need to delineate some aspects of game into good camps, pro-woman, pro-feminized monogamy, and bad camps, manipulative, polygynous, male-centered. Even in the admission of the truth that game has enlightened men of, the feminine imperative still seeks to categorize the application of game to serve its own end, that men might have some means of access to their own sexual strategy is too terrible a threat. Game must be colored good or bad as it concerns the imperatives of women and a fem-centric societal norm. As the default, socially correct, and virtuous concern, women have an easier time of this. As game becomes increasingly more difficult to deny or misdirect for the feminine, the natural step in accepting it becomes qualifying its acceptable uses. While hypergamy is an ugly truth about women, the characterization of it becomes just how women are, an unfortunate legacy of their evolution. However, for men, the characterizations of the harsher aspects of game in its rawest form, contingencies for hypergamy, are dubbed the dark arts by those who have an interest in maintaining feminine primacy. Myth of the dark arts. According to common definition, the dark triad is a group of three personality traits: narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy, all of which are interpersonally aversive. Depending upon context, that may be a convenient assessment of a sociopathic personality, but it is hardly an accurate assessment of game as a whole. In its desperation to come to terms with a more widespread acceptance of game, the feminine imperative had to make some effort to dissuade the common man, see beta, from embracing the means to his release from the feminine matrix. Associating game with dark triad personality traits makes this qualification process much easier, since the feminine imperative owns the messaging and the defining authority of what is social and what is antisocial. The problem then becomes one of defining what acceptable use of game is social and antisocial. Predictably, game-accepting women will want to cast game into terms that suit them individually and accommodates for their own personal conditions as well as the priorities of their particular phase of life. However, because of such diverse conditions, Consequently, there is a lot of disagreement amongst game-accepting women about what should constitute appropriate use. Thus, a pick-and-pull form of rationalization about aspects of game gets thrown about in their internal debates. For feminized men, this is a very confusing debate. It's difficult enough for them to accept that women love jerks, despite being told the contrary for half their lives by women. But for the game-accepting women they still think are quality, it's a bitter pill to swallow when these women debate the aspects of acceptable, lovable, jerk-like qualities and the evil, user, manipulative, dark art, jerk that only contextually misaligns with their present conditions and priorities. For both the plugged-in and the freshly unplugged, this is an incongruity that they have a tough time reconciling against the ideals of moralism that a femme-centric society has unwittingly convinced them of. While a broader understanding of hypergamy and game make for useful tools for enlightened single men, the game-accepting beta plug-in will still see it strictly as a means to satisfying the female imperative. Long-term provisional monogamy. Any deviation from this narrative, any guy using game for personal gain, personal pleasure, or to enact his own sexual strategy is guilty of crimes against feminized society. Since the societal greater good has been defined by the feminine imperative, anything counter to it is definitely evil, counterproductive, antisocial, and manipulative sociopathy.
The bitter taste of the red pill.
The truth will set you free, but it doesn't make truth hurt any less, nor does it make truth any prettier. And it certainly doesn't absolve you of the responsibilities that truth requires. One of the biggest obstacles guys face in unplugging is accepting the hard truths that game and a new awareness of gender relations forces upon them. Among these is bearing the burden of realizing what you've been conditioned to believe for so long were comfortable ideals and loving expectations are really liabilities. Call them lies if you want, but often there comes a certain sense of hopeless nihilism that accompanies what amounts to a system that you are now cut away from. It is not that you're hopeless. It's that you lack the insight at this point to see that you can create hope in a new system, one in which you have more direct control over. There are no dark arts. This is simply one last desperate effort of the feminine imperative to drag you back into the matrix. There is only game, and the degree to which you accept it and are comfortable in using it in the context that you define. If you choose the context of a mutually beneficial, mutually loving, mutually respecting LTR monogamy of your own choosing, know that it's the fundamentals of game that are at the root of its success or failure. If that context is in terms of spinning multiple plates, liberating the affections of women from other men, and enjoying a love life based on your personal satisfactions, also understand that it lives and dies based on your understanding the fundamentals of game. Just as alpha is not inherently noble or deplorable, game is neither inherently good nor evil. The devil is in the details, and whomever's defined context in which you use it. In the introduction section of the 48 Laws of Power, author Robert Greene explains the same about power. Power is neither good nor evil. It simply is. And your capacity to use power, your comfort in using it, doesn't invalidate the principles of power. Likewise, your discomfort or inability to accept those principles does not excuse you from the consequence of having that power used upon you. The unwritten 49th law of power is denying the utility of power itself, or demonizing its use both moralistically and socially. With the wide dispersion of game theory, this has been the reactionary tact of the feminine imperative. Appeal to the deeply conditioned moral, ethical, honorable, virtuous ideals, and feminine-specific obligations ingrammatically planted in men by a femme-centric society. While redefining the acceptable use of the same game, the feminine imperative demonizes for its own purposes.
Chapter 5, Part 1.
Game. The evolution of game. If you ever need a reminder as to how you came to a particular belief or set of beliefs, the best way to consider or reconsider that process is to write a book about it. The book you now hold in your hands is the compilation of the past 12 years of my involvement in the so-called manosphere. It wasn't even known as the manosphere back then. For the men and women who've read my ideas since the inception of the So Suave Forum almost 12 years ago, I expect they'll find this section kind of remedial, like going back over old classics they'd internalized and take for granted now. If I make a reference to hypergamy or the feminine imperative, for most, there's a standard level of pre-understanding about the elements associated to each of these and many other concepts. However, a problem of familiarity arises when I, or anyone else familiar with red pill awareness, makes an attempt to educate the unfamiliar. The red pill Reddit community makes a good effort of this, but after going through two revisions of this book, it became evident to myself and my editor that familiarizing the uninitiated is a major obstacle to reaching the men who will benefit most from unplugging. Yet another manosphere term. Familiarity. The majority of the requests I've received over the years for a comprehensive book of rational male ideology has come from readers expressing the desire for a condensed version in book form which they can give to family and friends, mostly male, in the hopes that they'll better understand their need for emancipation from their femme-centric mental models. Of course, that's always been my goal from day one, but it presumes that a large part of those reading will be unfamiliar with common terms and concepts I, or familiar readers, will already have a grasp of. Another issue I often run into is the presumption that readers new to my blog or commenters on other blogs have a familiarity with my work. I often find myself having to link back to articles where I covered a specific topic that a critic or an inquisitive reader might want to take me to task about. For the most part, I make a conscious effort not to repeat something I've addressed, sometimes years before, but that's simply a part of the medium of blogging. It's a difficult enough proposal to unplug men from their blue pill conditioning, but leading them to an understanding of principles they mentally have a resistance or aversion to is a particular challenge. For example, my editor is only peripherally familiar with these principles, which is kind of a blessing and a curse. In one sense, it requires me to revise old posts and concepts to be more noob-friendly. But it also challenges me to review how those concepts evolved over the years to be what I and other red pillars now consider foundations. For instance, while I might rigorously debate the concept of the feminine imperative with those familiar with it on Dalrock's blog, I had to spend over an hour defining it further with my editor after he'd read my seminal post about it. More on this later. Game. Of these concepts, the one I return to the most frequently is that of game. Just what is game? Throughout my blog, and virtually every major Manosphere writer's blog, there's a constant presumption that readers will know exactly what game is when it's referred to. Game has been lifted up to an almost mythical state, like some cure-all for the common guy struggling with attracting women's attentions and intimacy. It's gotten to the point where familiarity with game has become a flippant aside for Manosphere bloggers. We have varieties of game. We have internalized game. We have natural game, direct game, beta game, etc. But defining the term game for someone unfamiliar with the very involved intricacies, behaviors, and the underlying psychological principles on which game is founded is really tough for the uninitiated to wrap their heads around in the beginning. For the unfamiliar, just the word game seems to infer deception or manipulation. You're not being real if you're playing a game. So from the outset, we're starting off from a disadvantage of perception. This is further compounded when attempting to explain game concepts to a guy who's only ever been conditioned to just be himself with women and how women allegedly hate guys who play games with them. As bad as that sounds, it's really in the explanation of how game is more than the common perception that prompts the discussion for the new reader to have it explained for them. At its root level, game is a series of behavioral modifications to life skills based on psychological and sociological principles to facilitate intersexual relations between genders. Early game. In its humble beginnings, game was a set of behaviors learned, adapted, and modified with the express purpose of bettering a guy's prospective sexual success with the women he had only limited, if any, access to. Game was defined as a series of behavioral skills and techniques observationally experimented with and developed by the burgeoning pickup artist PUA culture of the early 2000s. While there was a peripheral acknowledgement given to the psychology that made these behavior sets effective, the purpose was more about the result and less about the head mechanics that made the result possible. The introduction was many of the current Manosphere's first contact with formalized game. The quality of the art in pickup artistry was, and still is, really left up to the practitioner's capacity to understand the basics of behavioral psychology with regards to women and refining a deft ability to adapt and react to his target's changing behavioral cues in a given environment and or context. If this were the only extent of game, it would understandably be very short-sighted and limited in scope. In the beginning, game had a utility in it that helped a majority of men lacking the social intelligence to approach and develop a real, intimate rapport with women they fundamentally lacked. The problem was that beyond game's infield uses, it wasn't really developed past the point of getting the girl, and left even the most socially adept PUAs unprepared to deal with the real psychology motivating women on a greater whole. It was just this feminine metapsychology that drove men unaccustomed to enjoying and then losing the affections of women formerly out of their league to depression and possibly suicide. Game was a wondrous tool set of skills, but without the insight and foresight to deal with what these tools could build, it was potentially like giving children dynamite. Evolving game. From the earliest inception, game was more or less viewed as a solution to a problem. Game has been described as the logical, social reaction to the women that the past 60 years of feminism social feminization, and feminine primacy has created for the men of today. Courtesy of modern connectivity, the internet, and collectivized social media, evolving game or some variation of it was inevitable for men. Despite the public social stigma, ridicule, and outright hostility attached to men attempting to understand the psychologies of women, privately, the internet facilitated a global consortium of men comparing experiences, relating observations, and testing theories. The behavioral psychology that led to game, which prompted the desired reactions in women, began to take on more importance for men. Sure, the now classic game techniques like being cocky and funny, amused mastery, agree and amplify, nag hits, peacocking, etc., were effective in their own artfully used context. But the latent psychology that made those behavior sets work prompted the questions of why they worked. The psychological aspects of effective and ineffective game began to take on a new importance. Through this broader exploration of the role biological, psychological, and sociological factors played in affecting game, new ideas have been sprung, along with new theories and experimentative models leading to new game behavioral sets and the abandonment of less effective ones. As connectivity grew, so did the knowledge base of the game community. No longer was game exclusive to the PUA pioneers. Game was expanding to accommodate the interests and influences of men who'd never heard of the earlier version of game, or would have rejected it outright just years before due to their feminine conditioning. Married men wondered if aspects of game could reignite the sexual interest of their frigid or overbearing wives. Divorced men embraced the game they ridiculed when married to improve their potential for new sexual interest, but also to relate their experiences and contribute to that game knowledge base. Men, not just in Western culture, but from a globalizing interest, began to awaken with each new contribution, not only about how women were, but why women were. Game was making the unknowable woman knowable. The enigmatic feminine mystique began unraveling with each new contribution to the game knowledge base. Game was becoming something more. Men were now seeing the code in the matrix. We knew the medium was the message. We began to see the feminine social conventions used to control us. We began to see the overarching reach of the feminine imperative and femcentrism. And we came to realize the insidious but naturalistic influence feminine hypergamy had wrought in both men and women. Game was prompting men to push back the iron veil of feminine primacy and see what made her tick. Predictably, femcentric society sought to cast the rise and expansion of game as a modern version of ridiculous macho archetypes of the 50s to the 70s. The threat of an evolving, more intellectually valid form of game had to be ridiculed and shamed like anything else masculine. So the association with its infamous PUA forerunners was the obvious choice for the feminine imperative. The feminine standard appeal to the masculine catch-22 was the first recourse. Any man who desired to learn game was less than a man for that desire, but also less of a man for not already knowing game, as approved by the feminine imperative. Any guy actually paying for, or personally invested in, game was associated with the PUA culture that was characterized as a throwback to the leisure suit Larrys of the 70s. Contemporary game. For all its marginalization efforts to shame game back into obscurity, The feminine imperative found that the game movement wasn't being cowed as easily as it might have been in the mid-1990s. The imperative was falling back on the reliable tropes and social conventions that had always pushed the masculine back into compliance. At the apex of femcentrism in the 90s, these social constructs worked well on an isolated, shamed, and ignorant masculine imperative. But with the evolution of the internet, by the late 2000s, game was snowballing into a threat that required new feminine operative conventions to contain it. Game evolved beyond the behavioral sets and beyond the psychological and sociological mechanics that underlined women's psyches and larger socializations. While still encompassing all that prior evolution, game was becoming aware of the larger social metascale of the feminine imperative. Game began to move beyond the questions of why women are the way they are, and into piecing together how the intergender acculturations we experience today are what they are. Game asked, how did we come to this? Game branched into specific areas of interest in its scope to answer these broader questions and solve more expansive problems. While we still have all of the prior iterations of game, we have expanded into Christianized game. Married, game. Divorced, game. Socialized, game. High school, game, etc. However, underpinning all of these areas of specialization was still the need to internalize and personalize game in a man's life. Game was the path to male re-empowerment, an empowerment that even women today still feel men should man back up to. Game required a reinterpretation of masculinity towards something positive, beneficial, and competent, something entirely apart from the negative, shameful, and ridiculous archetype 60 years of feminization had convinced women and men of. Call it alpha. Call it positive masculinity. But game necessitates the reimagining of the importance of the masculine imperative. Game needs men to change their minds about themselves. Needless to say, even in its most positive of context, the male re-empowerment that game led to was a threat too great for the feminine imperative to allow. Controlling the intrinsic insecurities that the feminine imperative is founded upon has always depended on men's ignorance of their true personal value and true necessity to women. Men have to be necessitous to women in order for their insecurity to be insured against and the feminine imperative's control to be ensured of. The well of knowledge and awareness that game represented had to be poisoned. The social conventions the feminine imperative had relied on for decades were no longer as effective as they were in a pre-internet era. The continued expansion of game into the social, psychological, evolutionary, and biological realms was evidence that game was something those old conventions couldn't contain. So the imperative evolved new tacks while reinventing old ones. Shaming and ridicule were, and still are, the rudimentary tactics that the less intellectual of the feminine imperative would resort to. But the expansiveness of game needed something more distorting. Proponents of the feminine imperative began to concede certain universal points that game had long asserted about the feminine nature and the feminine imperative had long rejected in an effort to co-opt the social momentum game had taken over a decade to develop. The feminine imperative couldn't argue with the extensive, provable validity of the tenets of game. So it sought, seeks, to re-engineer game from within and modify it to its own purpose. The feminine imperative wants just enough male empowerment to return men to an improved, really an older, state of usefulness to its own ends. But not so much that true male emancipation from the imperative would threaten its dominance. In co-opting game and conceding to the truth it finds less threatening, the imperative hopes to build better betas, men who believe they are empowered by game, but are still beholden to the feminine imperative. True emancipation from the imperative threatens its dominance, so men with the vision to see past this are labeled dark, sociopathic, and deviant by the imperative. It wasn't enough just to infiltrate game and sanitize it for its benefit. The feminine imperative had to categorize game for itself. Evil versus good game. The good, of course, being characteristic of whatever aspects benefited the imperative, and the bad being whatever selfishly benefited the masculine. The feminine imperative doesn't care about the various branchings of game. Natural, internalized, marriage, etc. It only concerns itself with what aspects of those branches that can be distorted to its advantage and what aspects cannot. This brings us to game as we know it today. Game is still evolving, and I had the prescience to see where it will go next. I would venture that it will come to men's real emancipation with the feminine imperative, not an emancipation from women, but an emancipation from their imperatives' conditioning and purpose, not a men going their own way negligence of women in the hope that they'll come around to behaving as men would like after being given no other choice, but a true game-driven emancipation from the control that femcentrism has maintained for so long. Make no mistake, the feminine imperative needs men to be necessitous of it, and it will always be hostile to the men attempting to free other men from that necessity.
Chapter 5. Continued. Part 2.
In this respect, any game, even the co-opted game the imperative will use itself, is by definition sexist. Anything that may benefit men, even when it associatively benefits women, is sexist. Freeing men from the matrix, breaking their conditioning, and encouraging them to reimagine themselves and their personalities for their own betterment is, by feminine definition, sexist. In girl world, encouraging men to be better men is sexist. Rewriting the rules. Women would rather share a successful man than be attached to a faithful loser. Pook. One of the most common things I'm asked on the SoSuave forum is, how do you keep a marriage fresh, Rolo? Among my responses to this is usually how, contrary to the advice column Oprah's standard answer, a good relationship should be effortless. All of this marriage is a constant work is bullshit, meant to keep a husband in a constant state of qualifying for his wife's intimacy, intended for her long-term frame retention. Women in marriage and LTRs want to push past that nagging hypergamic competition anxiety. They want security, not just financial, but emotional, and the security that comes from a locked-in commitment in knowing that they are the only source of sex and intimacy for their spouse or partner. Pre-commitment to commitment. One of the reasons sexual frequency declines for women after a romantic commitment is that the urgency of sex that was necessary prior to the commitment is replaced with the agency of sex being a reward. or reinforcer within that LTR. In single, uncommitted, non-exclusive life, sex, while being very enjoyable, becomes a proving ground for most women. In essence, it's the free samples before the buy. And its urgency is fueled not only by, hopefully, genuine attraction and arousal, but also at least the subconscious knowledge that she is in a sexual marketplace of competition. It's one of the few times in life when a woman must qualify for a man's approval. Admittedly, most men are so sex-deprived or so inexperienced early on in life that the sell is usually not a tough one for her. However, on some level of consciousness, even when the sell is virtually assured, she is aware that she could be replaced by a better competitor. Hypergamy drives women to sustain a prospective man's interest. This, then, is the contrast for committed sexual interaction. The dynamic now shifts from qualification sex to utility sex. Now, before anyone jumps to conclusions, yes, sex is still enjoyable. It can still be passionate. And she can definitely want it. But the impetus shifts. Sex is now a tool. In her uncommitted sex life, it was a tool for qualification. In her LTR life, it's a tool for compliance. This is pretty obvious, and it may be more or less extreme depending upon the woman's disposition or how important a particular issue is to her. But make no mistake, there isn't a woman on the planet who doesn't take her sexual agency into account when dealing with her LTR or husband. That agency may be more or less valuable, dependent upon her looks, demeanor, sexual availability, etc., in comparison to the sexual market value of the man she's paired with. And this is where the cardinal rule of relationships plays in. This is the constant interplay of vying for who is more dependent upon the other. Women have, for the past 50 plus years, made a concerted effort, and using social conventions, to establish their sexuality as the end-all for men in power. Vagina equals authority, and this is what all too many men parrot back to others and self-reinforce. Change. Do it. Sublimate your desires, or there won't be any nookie for you tonight, mister. On the surface, it seems intuitive to keep the peace and finish all the things on her honey-do list in the hopes that she'll recover even a fraction of the desire she had when you were single, childless, and getting blowjobs in the car after a date because she couldn't wait to get home to fuck you. The upper hand. Well, LTR gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that, yes, you do, in fact, have an intrinsic upper hand in this regard if you're fearless and willing to exercise your power. What I described in the last paragraph is simply the male deductive problem solving we use for so many other things in life. It's the most intuitive solution. Do what she says equals get sex. So it should come as no shock that the answer to this is counterintuitive. You must find ways to subtly return back to the state of competition anxiety she had in the beginning. I emphasize subtly because, as with everything else female, doing so overtly will be met with hostility, resentment, and at best, obligated compliance. To get more, any, sex, to retain the frame, to inspire more respect in her, you must disengage from her. That doesn't mean becoming arrogantly aloof, or sulking like a child, or becoming an instant asshole. Those are overt signs and methods. What is needed is incremental reassertion of yourself as the primary, and that her sexual agency, while still welcomed, is not a motivator for your own decisions. I'm fond of saying no vagina is worth years of regret. Yet this is exactly where most men find themselves, because they are either unwilling or unable to rock the vagina boat. They fail to understand that a woman's imagination is the most powerful tool in the Don Juan toolbox. The deductive and obvious way of stimulating that imagination would be to blurt out and say, "Look, bitch, your pussy's not made of gold, and there are plenty of other girls ready to polish my knob if you don't straighten up. See?" And this, of course, is met with either resistance or shame from her. What serves a man better is to make incremental changes in himself that she will perceive as attractive to other women. Women want to be with men who other women want to fuck, and other men want to be. This cuts both ways. The more empowered he becomes, the better physical shape he attains, the more professional achievements he gathers, the more social proof and status he accrues, the more valuable he makes himself, the more anxiety is produced. And this is the same old familiar competition anxiety a woman's hindbrain can't argue with. One of the first things I tell men trapped in a her-frame relationship is to get to the gym. Train hard. Look better. This has two effects. First, it makes her physical interest in fucking increase. And second, it fires up that imagination. Why is he doing this? He's really looking better these days. I see it. Other women must see it too. Maybe I need to start working out? Gosh, those girls at the gym look really good. She can't argue with a healthy desire to look better, feel better, and be concerned with your health. Getting in better shape is the easiest, most immediate change you can affect. You may have little influence in getting a promotion at work, but you can change your body habits right now. Women, being the calculating gender, know all too well to hit the gym months prior to a breakup. She's not getting in shape for you. She's getting ready to hit the ground running with the next guy she'll be fucking. They know this. So you're manifesting the same behavior caffeinates the hamster, since it hits home for them. Vagina is not authority. Don't accept that her sexuality is the authority of the relationship. The better you make yourself, the more authority you command. The more you abdicate to her, the less authority and respect you command. Women need to be told no. In fact, they want you to tell them no. Especially in light of the 800-pound gorilla in the room, her sexual agency. When a woman controls the LTR frame with her vagina, it's always going to color your dealings with her. This is no way to go through life. It becomes this ever-present, unspoken understanding that she can ultimately play the pussy card and you'll comply. While this may gratify her in the short term, you will lose her respect in the long term. She wants to be told no, in spite of you knowing she's going to hold out on you. This is the ultimate repudiation of her sexual agency. If he says no, with the foreknowledge that he knows he won't be getting any, my sexual powers are devalued. If her sexual agency is called into question, it leaves room for doubt and opens the door once again for competition anxiety to creep back in. As I've said before, marriage is no insulation against the sexual marketplace. and no one knows this better than women who can rely on a society that rewards them for recognizing it. Use that to your benefit now. Nothing is as simultaneously fear-inspiring and arousing for women as a man she suspects is self-aware of his own value. This is precisely why a feminized culture must continually confuse him, continually inspire doubt, and humiliate him. Feminization can't afford men knowing their true value and potential. In the end, who cares if you don't get laid for a week? It's well worth the price for increasing her respect for you as a commodity, and increasingly an authority. If you want to maintain that anxiety, you must perpetuate yourself as being a commodity women will compete for, even, especially, in the confines of committed monogamy. Final exam. Navigating the sexual marketplace. You know, there's really no substitute for graphs and charts and data plot maps. Human beings, as essentially a visually oriented species, see a graphic heads-up display, a God's eye view, as it were, as essential to seeing the forest for the trees. You may not like being on a budget at home, but show a guy a graph of where all his money goes in a month, and he'll feel better about not pissing it away for a peck on the cheek over the course of a couple weekends. So it was with this in mind that I took it upon myself to plot out a chronology of the little-known and far too underappreciated sexual marketplace, SMP, we presently find ourselves experiencing, at least since the sexual revolution. Bloggers in the manosphere often use the SMP in a context which presumes that readers are already familiar with their mental model of it and understand the dynamics of the modern SMP. Personally, I think this presumption is fraught with individual bias, both intended and unintended. Make no mistake, I'm about to define the SMP and sexual market values, SMV, from my own perception. But I fully recognize the want for defining these dynamics in a clear, understandable format. So I'll beg my reader's forgiveness for this indulgence. Can I graduate? At the time of this writing, it was about graduation time for many high school seniors. And with that comes a lot of pontification from adults who want to impart some grand words of wisdom to the next generation as they launch headlong into a future of student debt and or dismal employment prospects. This is a special time for parents and childless adults alike to reflect upon their own lives and ask themselves, what would I tell my younger self to do differently? And hope against hope that the 18-year-old they feel compelled to cast in the role of their younger selves will tear themselves away from texting their friends about who's going to get whom to buy their graduation night liquor long enough for it to sink in. So you'll have to forgive me for playing the professor here for a moment, while I make the same vain attempt. Not long ago, I had a commenter tell me, "Rolo, I just wanted to say that your stuff has been truly groundbreaking for me. This material should be a graduation requirement for all high school seniors." Well, far be it from Dr. Rolo J. Tomasi, Professor Emeritus, to be so remiss in his sacred charge of educating the next generation about the perils of the sexual marketplace they would otherwise so blindly stagger into. Challenge accepted. So please gather round the podium. Turn off all your cellular devices. Graduation night liquor's easy to come by. Take a sheet of notebook paper from your peachy folder and prepare to take notes on Navigating the SMP. Now, class, If you'll direct your attention to the display above, I'll explain the parameters of this graph. In the vertical column, we have sexual market value, SMV, based on the ubiquitous 10 scale. Professor Roy C. Emeritus at the Chateau Hartist did us all the good service of elaborating upon individuated sexual market valuations for both men and women long ago. However, for our purposes today, it is important to note that the valuations I'm illustrating here are meant to encompass an overall sexual value based on both long and short-term breeding prospects, relational desirability, male provisioning capacity, female fertility, sexual desirability and availability, etc. et al. Your mileage may vary, but suffice it to say the 10 scale is meant to reflect an overall value as individuated for one sex by the other. Outliers will always be an element of any study, but the intent is to represent general averages here. On the horizon metric, we have a timeline based on the age of the respective sex. I've broken this down into stages of 5-year increments, but with notable ages represented for significant life to valuation phase for each sex to be detailed in our lecture. As an aside here, you may notice I began the SMV age range at 15. This is intentional as it is the baseline starting point for the average girl's mid-range desirability value as evaluated by the average high school boy of the same age. Also of note will be the age range between 23 and 36, which represents the peak span years between the sexes. Also to be detailed later. Lastly, I've delineated each gender's respective SMV range bell curve and indicated their crossover phases accordingly. Women's SMV. In various contexts, women's SMV is without doubt the most discussed topic in the manosphere. Try as we may, convincing a woman that her sexual peak lay actually between 18 and 25 is always an effort in debating denial. For all the self-convincing attempts to redefine sexual valuation to the contrary, SMV for women is ultimately decided by men, not by women. Thus, this bell curve is intended to represent the sexual value of women based on men's metrics, not as women, by way of ceaseless social engineering, would like to define desirability. As we continue along, you can see the peak years for women's SMV tops out at around 23 years. Fertility, desirability, sexual availability, and really overall potential for male arousal and attention reach an apex between 22 and 24 years of age. Remember, this approximation isn't an estimate of personal worth, fidelity, intellect, character, or any metric beyond a baseline of desirability invoked in men. Ladies, on average, this is your best year. I don't think I'm relating anything the cold truth of your hindbrain hasn't woken you up at night over. At no other phase in a woman's life will she enjoy more affirmation or legitimate male attention, more zealously applied for her sexual approval, than this brief stretch. Once past the apex, every effort she spends on generating male arousal cues will be an attempt to recapture the experiences of this phase. Every post-apex, pre-wall, 24 to 30 calorie women burn will be motivated by the memories of her SMV peak. By the age of 27, women's SMV decline has begun in earnest. That isn't to say women can't remain stunningly attractive and vivacious in their post-peak years, but comparative to the next crop of 22 to 23-year-olds, the decline progressively becomes more evident. Competition for hypergamously suitable mates becomes more intensified with each passing year. The ages between 27 and 30 are subliminally the most stressful for women as the realization sinks in that they must trade their party years, short-term mating protocol, for a long-term provisioning strategy. It's at this point